Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vagha Mradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Later in the program, Todd Harrison and Seamus Daniels of the Center for Strategic and International Studies on their fourth annual list of bad national security ideas. But first, joining us is Dr. Ron Epstein of Bank of America Merrill Lynch, who normally joins us for our weekly business report to discuss Lockheed Martin's proposed acquisition of Aerojet Rocketdyne in a $4.4 billion deal that will require government regulatory approval. Ron, thanks very much for joining us again.
Yeah, happy to be here, Vagha.
And before we get started, Leonardo DRS sponsors our global coverage, Northrop Grumman, our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall, Fincantieri, Marinette Marine, our naval coverage, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, our coverage of strategy, and Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. As everybody knows, we tape our business podcast every Sunday, and this announcement came out hours after the podcast went out, so thanks for joining us again today. The deal would vertically integrate Lockheed Martin's capabilities, enhancing competitiveness in growth markets where Aerojet has capabilities or is a key enabler, and that includes hypersonic, long-range strike, tactical strike, air defense, and space, where competitors like SpaceX and Northrop Grumman are also vertically integrated. SpaceX makes its own engines, and Northrop acquired Orbital ATK and got an engine capability that way. Lockheed is a 50-50 partner with Boeing in the United Launch Alliance, which constitutes, correct me if I'm wrong, Ron, about 40% of Aerojet Rocketdyne's business. The question is whether competitors like Raytheon Technologies or even Boeing, for that matter, will complain to the Pentagon, who also wants as much competition as possible in any area it deems a growth area, and obviously hypersonics are there, long-range strike, space, and so on. Ron, what's your view and the market view of this deal, especially at this price point, which is 15 times EBITDA on about $2 billion in sales?
I would say this, Vagha. There's a lot of head-scratching going on, honestly, on the timing of the deal, on the valuation of the deal. When you look at it, right, like you mentioned, between the vertical integration of Lockheed and United Launch Alliance, about 40% of this thing is Lockheed related. So it's a big play on vertical integration. About a third, just under a third of Aerojet Rocketdyne's revenue is to NASA. Generally, folks don't see that as a big growth area. When you look at the growth of Aerojet Rocketdyne, it's projected to be very low single digit growth. When you try to ferret out of this, the financials, you know, and what kind of impact it's going to have on earnings per share, how accretive will it be from a cash flow perspective, it's actually pretty modest early on. This is clearly a play for the longer term. And that's kind of where we are. I mean, if you look at the way that the two stocks are trading, both Aerojet and Lockheed, you know, there's the so-called ARBs, and there's a spread between the stocks. That spread is suggesting that the ARBs think that there is some risk to the deal actually closing.
Aerojet Rocketdyne is a historic company, an enormous amount of technology, key enabler, small rockets, small rocket motors, obviously a strong suit. They also have some other discriminating technology like throttleable solid rocket motors and the like. So what do you think Lockheed saw, right? Because the company had also been owned by United Technologies and by Boeing at one point.
Yeah, so at least the Rocketdyne piece was. I think there's a couple things that Lockheed is probably seeing here. One, they fancy themselves as the hypersonics house, which is true. I mean, if you look at what they've won, this maybe cements that. Two, they probably get a bigger piece of GBSD by doing this, right? Because Aerojet Rocketdyne is a supplier on GBSD. So this gives them a bigger piece of GBSD. When you look down the road and you're thinking maybe medium term, longer term, and if you do believe the national security strategy is going to drive more stuff in space, this is an angle on that. I think those are probably all things they're thinking. I think when you think about the vertical integration angle on this, there's two sides to it. One, you could say, well, why do you want to vertically integrate that? And the two is, they are a big supplier to you. Maybe you want to be in control of your own destiny, right? So you could argue that. You could argue that both ways. But interestingly enough, when investors and other folks think about this, now this is a property, at least part of it, which was already owned by Boeing at one point and already owned by United Technologies, which is at least half of Raytheon Technologies today.
Lockheed obviously is arguing that the acquisition, its acquisition of Aerojet, mirrors Northrop's acquisition of Orbital ATK, right? And so that consent decree or something similar to that should work, given that Orbital ATK is also a merchant supplier to a lot of folks. But that didn't stop Boeing, for example, protesting against the deal. And in fact, Boeing decided not to bid on the Air Force's ground-based strategic deterrent, as you said, GBSD, in part because it said that Northrop has an unfair advantage by controlling the rocket motor maker, that Thiokol is part of the Orbital ATK family at the end of the day, and Thiokol made the motors for the Minuteman that is being upgraded under GBSD. What are the grounds under which other companies are going to protest? Why, for example, if you are Raytheon, would you protest it, right? I mean, it would be because of the standard missile, presumably.
That would be one reason why. In aggregate, if you look at the revenue at Aerojet Rocketdyne per their 2019 financials, their last year-end report, about 17% of revenue was attributable to Raytheon as a customer. So Raytheon is a material customer for them. So it's more than just a standard missile. There's other programs they're on. So, Raytheon could find that objectionable, right? I mean, that wouldn't be that big a surprise. That said, however, unlike the solid rocket boosters that are, fabricated by Thiokol, Thiokol is the only supplier of those things. Between Aerojet and Orbital ATK, which is now part of Northrop, you do have alternative sources. I think a bigger, more interesting question becomes, is the Department of Defense going to be comfortable with both, domestic historical rocket producers being part of large defense contractors, where you have, the Orbital ATK piece sitting in Northrop and the Aerojet Rocketdyne piece sitting in Lockheed? Are they going to want that? And then another question that, of course, will come to mind is what is the impact that this will have ultimately on innovation and product development? Aerojet Rocketdyne going to be more productive from a product development research perspective under Lockheed's umbrella or independently? That's an open question, but that's something that, of course, the DoD will have to try to evaluate.
And let me ask you briefly, what's the risk of announcing a deal like this so late at the end of one administration when another administration is about to take over that could have a fundamentally different view, antitrust view, right? I mean, it's a little bit reminiscent to Jack Welch announcing his Honeywell acquisition plans, GE, I think it was like October 2000, and only to find it rejected by the Bush administration.
Well, I think you
articulate. I should say, actually, right, regulators in Europe, I should say, ultimately were also a key deciding factor in that deal. But
well, I think you articulated it really well. You don't know, what hurdles you're going to have to deal with, right? That's an evolving target, if you will, as we speak, literally. So doing something like this late in administration into a new administration brings with it its own risks, precisely for the reason that you said around, views on antitrust, but not just views on antitrust, but antitrust within the national security space, right? As you know, I mean, it's a little bit of a different environment, and the new administration's take on that, we just don't know yet, right? I mean, that's just going to come out with time. And that for sure is, one of the risks to this, and that's probably why you're seeing the market receive the deal the way it is. And the point being, the way the shares are trading today, it's like it could happen. That's what the market's saying, but the market isn't saying it's gonna happen.
Ron, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. And if we don't talk to you between now and then, hope you have a terrific holiday. And looking forward to having you back on next Sunday.
Yeah, thanks, Fargo, and have a happy Christmas.
At the end of each of the last 4 years, Todd Harrison and his team at the Center for Strategic and International Studies issues a list of bad ideas. This year, by the time all is said and done with, there will be about 20 bad ideas, and there might actually be one good one. And they even have a little song that Todd wrote to get you into the holiday spirit of turning a new leaf for the new year. Todd and his colleague Seamus Daniels are joining us today to discuss the 2020 list of bad ideas with as much cheer as possible. Todd and Seamus, welcome back to the show.
Bah humbug.
Seamus, are you going to be more cheerful than Todd?
Vago, thanks for having us. Thanks for putting up with us.
Absolutely. This is one of the highlights of the year. And I agree with most of what you guys have posted. There are going to be a couple of more. So 16, I think, or 17 or so are out. It'll be 20 by the time we get to the end of the year. Todd, start us off. Even on a list of 20 bad ideas, there are ideas that are worse than others. Walk us through the baddest of the bad ideas.
The best of the worst, the worst.
The best of the worst, exactly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as background, you know, obviously working at an esteemed institution like CSIS, we spend 11 months of the year focusing on what are good policy ideas, right? How can we improve defense policy, foreign policy? You know, what are the good things that we should be working for? And how can we make existing policies even better? It's just this one month of the year, we take a little time and we look at what are the terrible ideas that are out there that just won't go away and need to be called out. And of course, we don't have a monopoly on bad ideas. There are plenty of them out there. And so we open this up not just to folks across CSIS, but to folks at other think tanks and academic institutions as well, and invite them to nominate bad ideas and then write a short article talking about why it's a bad idea and what we should be doing instead. And, you know, of course, in all of this, you know, we believe in scholarly independence. So the bad ideas that are up there, I don't necessarily agree with all of them. Seamus doesn't agree with all of them, right. But we put them out there to really kind of provoke thought and hopefully get people, you know, a little deeper understanding about what the issue is at stake.
And I thought there were a couple of particularly good ones, right? I mean, I love Suzanne Spaulding's idea, prioritizing STEM education at the expense of civic education is a mistake, right? That one of the big problems that we have as society is this, you know, lack of understanding that we're all in it together and how the institutions of government work. So I thought that was a great piece. I thought the great power competition one, you know, stop calling it great power competition, but it's because it's sort of muddles the issue. I thought your piece that you did, I think, with Nick Harrington about, you know, conflating great power competition and high intensity war fighting or combat was a good one. And even some of your space ideas, you know, even some of your space ideas, you know, were you know, were the space stuff was actually really, really good. Let's start with the great power competition one and high intensity conflict.
Yeah. Well, first of all, the earlier great power competition one by Zach Cooper, my former colleague, now at AEI, I think he hit the nail right on the head that, you know, the term itself maybe needs to be adjusted, right? You don't want to conflate Russia with China. They're very different challenges. And it also, you know, another major point he makes is it kind of devalues the contribution of our allies who aren't really great powers and makes it sound like it's just a competition between us and China or us and Russia. Right. And really it's a multi-pronged competition. But you know, the piece that Nick and I wrote, and I'll tell you, you know, as background, we actually wrote two separate pieces, not knowing what the other was writing. Seamus did not coordinate us very well. Am I right, Seamus?
Thanks. Thanks, Todd. I really appreciate that.
So I wrote a piece on that topic. Nick wrote a piece on that topic. And then we like looked at them and realized, oh, we're actually writing the same thing. So we merged them together. And I think it was even better for it. But the idea is basically, you know, you hear people talk about this in senior levels of DOD, and they seem to sometimes just conflate preparing for great power competition with focusing on high intensity combat and the capabilities that you need for high intensity combat. When that's absolutely true, that's part of it, but that is not the only dimension of our competition with Russia and with China. In fact, a major part of that competition is likely to be in the gray zone, that is below the threshold of overt military conflict.
I should have also mentioned, you know, I gave a shout out to Suzanne's piece, which I thought was good. Tom Spohr of the Heritage Foundation, who heads the defense program there, had a great piece also that excluding qualified leaders from Pentagon service because of defense industry experience is also a bad idea. And I agree with that. And then Mark Kansian and Wes Rumbaugh also have some great pieces, space being a familiar refrain. Seamus, what are some of the ones that stood out for you?
Jonathan Wong from RAND wrote his idea on overly focusing on speed in development and acquisition. And, you know, he's making the point that in DOD, we see so many organizations today, different acquisition chiefs, different acquisition departments, and they're all focusing on the speed of how quickly can they get out the next platform, the next generation weapon system. When in reality, he's saying, you know, we shouldn't be focusing exclusively on speed. If we focus exclusively on speed, that's when we're going to see issues coming up with sustainment, with program management. But, you know, it's also, he's recognizing that, yes, you have these programs in the past, like the F-22 that drag on for ages. And by the time that they're finally released, you know, are they actually what we need today in the current threat environment? So I think he pays recognition to the fact that, yes, time is significant. We should try to get things out in a timely fashion. But if we're focusing on that, that's when we're going to run into issues.
You know, and that's a good one, Bago, because you see the pendulum swing back and forth on this all the time in different administrations. And, you know, you can think of it as the iron triangle of engineering, right? You know, you can optimize for cost, you can optimize for schedule, or you can optimize for performance, but you can't optimize for all three at once. And, you know, we've seen it like the Better Buying Power Initiative was clearly, you know, focusing more on costs. Now we're focusing more on speed. I would argue back in the, you know, Rumsfeld era, the transformational era, if you will, they were focused much more on performance, right? And so we see this swing back and forth and back and forth. And it's, I'm glad you wrote this paper to just raise people's awareness of the fact that, hey, you are making trade-offs here, and they might not necessarily be the trade-offs that you want.
I appreciate folks saying that as a refrain, somewhat disagree with it, because at the end of the day, you can do it fast and right. And throughout history, we've shown that we can. And actually, some of the biggest disasters we had weren't attributed to speed, right? I mean, the problems littoral combat ship or future combat systems, or I even dare say whether it's F-35 or F-22, these programs weren't rushes to judgment. They sort of ground through a conventional acquisition program and still ended up a little bit, you know, I mean, did F-35 end up being a great program and it'll serve very, very well? Yes. Did F-22 deliver capabilities no other airplane can? Yes. But I just find that you can do it fast and well at the end of the day. So there's a little bit of skepticism.
There is a bit of caution.
Absolutely. Right. I mean, yeah. you don't want to move too fast and do something stupid at the end of the day.
Right. Well, and, you know, the mantra at NASA back in the 1990s was faster, better, cheaper. They're trying to do all three at once. And, you know, there's a few craters in Mars now to show the results of that, that you can't always do all three at once. So, you know, just be conscious of the trade-offs that you're making.
You know, walk us through the space pieces, because I think space was probably the best represented field, probably of the bunch. Walk us through some of the space pieces, and then Todd, get your sense on that as the resident spaceman, space marshal at CSIS.
Well, we actually had three or four space pieces in this series, and surprisingly, Todd did not write any of them. Just randomly, I'll start off with Joseph Moy's piece, a Marine fellow with CSIS, on disestablishing the Space Force. He's laying out all the reasons why we should keep the Space Force. And, you know, it actually matches up pretty well with our colleague McKenna Young's piece on why we shouldn't reverse Trump-era NASA programs in a new administration. What McKenna is arguing is that, you know, two NASA initiatives, the Artemis program and LEO commercialization, are critical to the future of space exploration. And this isn't something that the Biden administration should take a step back from.
Todd or Seamus, at this point, do we know how the Biden administration is going to go on this? Because I think, you know, there is this sense that now that Space Force has been launched, whether or not it was a good idea or not, it now is something that exists. And the important thing is to push it to where it should be, which is include NRO, which is a major customer, and components of the other military services, which so far has not happened, right? I mean, it's something that is the Air Force's space assets that became the Space Force. And certainly on a NASA, from a NASA standpoint, right, each administration does come into it with their own priorities at the end of the day. Do we know where Team Biden's going to go on that, on either of those questions?
Yeah, so, you know, I think it's fair to say that if the Space Force did not already exist, the Biden administration was probably not going to be the ones to push for creating it. But now that it is created, and, you know, the legislative history on it is it had bipartisan support before Trump ever talked about it, at least in the House, is that, yeah, it's here to stay. It's already established in law. I don't see any indication that the Biden administration is going to try to roll that back. I think the real question is, how hard are they going to push to continue the planned transition of organizations and personnel over to the Space Force? So in that transition plan, it's a multi-year plan that the Trump administration had come out with. We're only 1 year into it now. And so the first year was all about moving the Air Force's space organizations and personnel and budgets over. And so that's going along well, probably a little slower than expected, but these things take time and it's better to get it right than to go too fast. But the big work that's left to be done is figuring out what are the space programs and organizations and personnel that need to transfer from the other services. And so a lot of that is actually going to be up to the Biden administration to execute on that. And I think that is critical for making sure that we get this right. Because the last thing I think anyone wants is at the end of this reorganization to end up with, you know, four or five space forces rather than one consolidated space force. So that, you know, is going to be a big job for the Biden administration. It's not clear, though, you know, how strongly they feel about this and how much, you know, energy and capital they're willing to expend to get this right.
Todd, I was just going to say that I think that links nicely to Wes Rumbaugh's piece in Bad Ideas. And so he's basically making the argument that we've seen the Trump administration continually try to push space-based missile tracking sensors, try to move it over from the Missile Defense Agency into the Space Development Agency. And each year that they're doing this, Congress comes back and finally tells them, you're not doing that. It's sticking in MDA. But I think that's just highlighting one of the continued battles or one of the continued issues that the Biden administration is going to have to tackle. And it's not only moving it over from the services, it's eventually deciding what are we going to do with these Missile Defense Agency assets as well.
Yeah, so it's a complicated question when you've got, you know, different parts of the program, different parts of the capability developed in different organizations. You know, ideally, sure, you might want to do that all in one consolidated acquisition organization, but you're talking about existing programs, right? And, you know, you don't necessarily want to disrupt something that's already underway that's got goodness to it.
Just a couple of more questions. I mean, obviously, there's so much richness here. There was a question about the Joint All-Domain Command and Control System and a little bit of a concern that this system isn't going to be create the fluidity and the distributed operations as intended, but actually could become something that worsens the problem by centralization. Talk to us a little bit about Mark Sipes' piece.
I think Mark wrote a really interesting piece pointing out that, you know, if you take this concept of joint all domain command and control, you know, too far and you focus too much on the idea of we want everything to connect into one centralized network without thinking about the vulnerability of that network, then you're setting yourself up for failure, right? That you've got, this isn't just about centralization. It's about connecting, you know, disparate platforms and units to one another in real time and understanding that that network is going to be attacked. It's going to be broken. It's likely to be broken into pieces. So you might end up in, you know, the battle space with a certain tactical unit of forces of different types that can all network together, but they can't network with others, right? They can't talk to anyone outside of their network. That is the way we know that Russia and China are thinking about attacking our systems. And of course, you know, today, we've got a lot of platforms that they have very little connectivity. Right. And so there's a lot of improvement to be made. But I think he's pointing out that you don't want to just focus on centralization of having everything be dependent on a central network, because in reality, that's going to be attacked and it's not going to work.
And we're having this conversation in the wake of the most serious cyber attack in American history, where Russians have not just penetrated virtually every arm of government, but also across industry, unfortunately. Seamus, if I can go to you really quickly and get your sense on two of the pieces. You know, earlier you mentioned failing to think about the defense budget at the margins, which I thought was interesting. And that was Justin's piece. And then Mark Kansian had an interesting piece about treating the Pentagon and the White House as if they were people, right? And that's not what it is. And he thinks it sort of muddles the political process. Give the audience kind of a quick taster on each of those.
Yeah, I think failing to think on the margins of the defense budget by Justin Joffrion, who's in the Air Force, is one of my favorite pieces in this series, because he touches on this idea that really, you know, plagues thinking and defense planning and defense budget analysis, that it's all or nothing. If we don't have this unique capability, then it's a failure. If we don't have a certain size Air Force, a certain size Navy, it's going to set us back. But what he's really making the argument is that we have to think incrementally when it comes to the budget, because, you know, everyone likes to point out that it's very hard to actually find savings in the defense budget. But if you think on the margin and say, well, what is the extra cost of adding one more aircraft carrier, one more F-35? Those costs will add up over time if you actually want to generate savings within the defense budget. So I think that's a great way to actually think about how to generate change within defense planning. Now, Mark Kansian had a little bit different take, which is a little on the rhetorical side. He says it's a bad idea to treat the Pentagon, quote unquote, and the White House as if they were people. And really, he's looking at when reporters, when analysts basically use these phrases collectively to refer to decision makers within those buildings. So what he's arguing for is a little more nuance, because if you're saying something comes out of the Pentagon, you know, you don't necessarily know whether that's coming out of the Office of the Secretary of Defense, right, if it's coming out of one of the services. And you don't actually see the debate and the decision-making that probably prompted that process. So he's urging people to be a little more specific when they're talking about defense policymaking.
Well, if you were being a good reporter, right, the building can't say anything, the White House can't say anything, the Pentagon can't say anything, individuals inside of them can. And the only way you could sort of differentiate between the two is when you use the term Pentagon to mean OSD, and you use then the services maybe as a way. But he makes an excellent point that it does muddle the nuances of some of the of some of the policy decisions and where we want to go. Let me ask another budget question, our mutual friend Bob Hale, and direct you this to you, Todd. Sort of use it or lose it budgeting, right? I mean, it's astonishing to many people that it is a you lose it or use it or lose it mentality. And we're doing this with billions and billions of dollars in taxpayer money, right? I mean, this isn't your condo board, you know, figuring out whether or not there's some money left over, so let's buy some pool furniture, right? Talk to us a little bit about the gravity, really, and the importance of what Bob is arguing as a former comptroller.
Yeah. And if, you know, if there's anyone who would understand this, it's Bob Hale, right? And so what he was pointing out in his piece is that this, you know, the way it is set up in current law is that operation and maintenance funding and military personnel funding has to be obligated within the year it's appropriated. If not, at the end of the year, it, you know, with a few exceptions, it expires and reverts to the Treasury. And of course, you know, no one in DOD and no one in Congress really wants to see that happen. You know, this money's been appropriated for a purpose. They want to see it used. The problem with having this hard deadline to spend it within the year it's appropriated for, you know, MLPERS and O&M is it leads to bad behavior. It leads to a rush to spend that, you know, any amounts of money that are remaining in those final weeks before the end of the fiscal year. And that rush to spend, you know, it clearly results in poor decision making and, you know, inefficient allocation of resources. He cites in his piece, you know, a 2010 study where, you know, if you look at spending week by week of money, that the final week of the fiscal year spending was four times higher than the average weekly spending during the rest of the year. And it's not unique to DOD either. It's in other federal agencies where they have the same use it or lose it rules around their funding. So, you know, and I think Congress is increasingly becoming a little more sympathetic to this and considering, you hear some folks in the Armed Services Committees talking about this from time to time, letting DOD carry over some small portion of its O&M and MLPERS dollars into the beginning of the next fiscal year. It doesn't require a huge change. It could just be allowing, you know, a 5% carryover or even less. And it doesn't have to carry over into the entire next year. It could just be with, you know, could just be within the first quarter of the year or a little longer. That would make a huge difference though, and helping the department get the time it needs to properly execute that money in an efficient, effective way.
We have a very brief amount of time left. I should point out to the audience that you crafted, you know, aside from all of your other skills, budget, former Air Force officer, space expert, national security, policy acquisition, Todd, you're also quite the songwriter. I think Irving Berlin.
I think
there's
some who would disagree with that.
And it's then to Santa Claus is coming to town, right? Do you want to give us kind of a little brief? We see when you're thinking.
I will read it. How about I'll read it?
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. All right.
Todd, we don't need to hear you sing. We'd prefer
really
to hear Vago sing.
Yeah, that's right. They're going to cancel your podcast, Vago, if I sing this stuff. But so I wrote a little poem, you know, to the tune of Santa Claus is Coming to Town. So it says, we see you when you're thinking. We know when you're in doubt. We like to find the bad ideas and can't help but call them out. So you better read now. You're going to have fun. You better not stop until we're all done. Bad ideas are coming all week.
Very well. Extraordinary. Thank you. Terrific, terrific job. Something more serious to end this podcast on. Russia conducted an anti-satellite test. Talk to us a little bit about this test, right? They fired just about a week or so, or last week, something into space, and then they shot it down. Talk to us about the test and what does it mean at a time when U.S. concerns about Russia and Chinese space capabilities are increasing, hence justifying the need for a space force, for example.
You know, it's one of these things where, you know, you want to pretend and say, oh my God, I am shocked. Russia has told us that they will not be the first to weaponize space. I can't believe they did this. And yet here we go again. Right. So this is, I think if I'm counting right, this is like the third anti-satellite test of 2020 by Russia. So they've been up to lots of things in space. And so this was a direct ascent anti-satellite missile that they launched, a kinetic kill missile. And, you know, it's just, you know, yet another test of their systems that they keep doing. Earlier back in July, U.S. Space Command called out the Russians because they had a core orbital ASAT weapon that they tested. This is a satellite that had actually been behaving like an inspector satellite, getting close right to other satellites in space. It then approached another Russian satellite and appeared to fire a projectile. So this was a space-based anti-satellite weapon, kinetic, you know, one satellite firing a projectile at another. And right, what we see here is another test of a ground-based anti-satellite weapon. You know, this just, I think, should further solidify the fact that, you know, we're in a new era in the space competition. It is not like it was in the Cold War, where we can expect that deterrence will hold in space, because Russia had these anti-satellite capabilities back in the Cold War, even the co-orbital ASAT weapons they tested dozens of times during the Cold War. But, you know, we weren't as worried about them using them at that time, except in the big one, the big war. So, you know, because many of our space systems were actually used to support nuclear forces, the same was true of them. And so we had this understanding, a pretty explicit understanding, that any attack on the other country's national technical means would be regarded as a prelude to a nuclear attack. So nuclear deterrence actually extended into space. That's just not true anymore. Right, because our space systems are used to support the full spectrum of combat operations and supporting our economy as well. Things like GPS. A lot of people forget that the Space Force actually operates and runs the GPS constellation of satellites that we use every day. And so I think this is just a further reminder that, you know, we've got to focus our efforts on building better protections for our space systems and space architectures that are going to be more resilient. And we can't afford to lose time on that.
Todd and Seamus, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it. Thanks for spending so much time with us this year. Hope you and yours and the whole CSIS team there have very happy holidays and a happy new year. And looking forward to working with you in 2021. Thanks so much again.
Thanks, Vago.
Thanks for having us.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.